Thanks for listening to the Greater Boston Startup Culture Podcast. This podcast is a production of Culture Envy, LLC. I'm Corey McAvini, and you can learn more about the startup culture conversation at www.cultureenvy.com. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce our guests for this evening. Julianne Zimmerman comes to us from Vodia Ventures, and Rich Levitt is here from William Gallagher Associates. And Vaughn Bryant is here from Foley Hoag. So please give them a warm welcome, and then I'll start grilling them. If you care to start off, whoever wants to start, if we could start off with just a brief background of what your role is in startup culture and advising the startups that you work with, and how you interact with startups on a daily basis.
Sure. So again, my name is Julianne Zimmerman. I'm co-founder and managing director of a seed stage venture firm called Vodia Ventures, which is one way I interact with startups every day. Not only the ones who pitch us, but our portfolio companies as well, with whom we work pretty closely. I'm also the co-chair of the innovation series for the MIT Enterprise Forum, which is a body that seeks to connect people across the innovation ecosystem here in the Boston area, across all technology sector segments, all market sectors, from bench research to commercial impact, with specifically the goal of catalyzing interactions that wouldn't necessarily otherwise happen, and leading people to go pursue things together or on their own that they might not have otherwise done had they not had those interactions. And I'm also a mentor with MIT Venture Mentoring Service, and I'm a mentor and judge with Mass Challenge and the 100K and a few other organizations. So I interact with entrepreneurs and startups in a variety of different capacities.
My name is Rich Levitt, and I'm with William Gallagher Associates, and my company serves the insurance brokerage, risk management, and employee benefits needs of startup companies, probably some in this room tonight. We work with, at any one time, 800, 900 different startups, and as you know, some make it, some don't. My side is more on the property and casualty, and what we do day in and day out is help companies understand what they need to have for insurance, how much it's going to cost, when to buy it. On the risk management side of it, a lot of it for us is getting involved with you as you start to grow, looking at all the different contracts that you have to sign, and hopefully pulling you back from signing things that you don't have insurance or indemnification for. And then the other role we play is really getting involved if events do happen at the company, such as terminations that go awry, and making sure that we're helping you get those claims in and paid when things do go wrong.
My name is Vaughn Bryant, and I am with Foley Hoag, a law firm in the Seaport. Hopefully some of you have heard of it. We are really active in venture capital, the startup scene. I mean, the firm does everything, but I, in particular, work with startups, do M&A, and also some private equity. And in terms of direct involvement, I speak to founders almost every day. I'm the person that they don't always want to hear from, but I'm saying, hey, sign this. You know, I say that a lot. Sometimes I want an automatic response that says sign this or something. But deal with founders a lot, investors a lot. We represent VC funds as well. There's a lot of activity right now, of course, a startup culture, and then also in the Seaport being dubbed the Innovation Center. So it's really good to be over there, happy to be there, and happy to be here tonight to hopefully shed some light on some areas that Corey's going to bring up.
Great. Well, thanks. In your experience, what are some of the most common challenges you see within the startups that you work with when it comes to team dynamics? Julianne, if you want to start.
Yeah, sure. Well, so the first thing I would say is, since tonight's topic is startup culture, Whether you are thinking about creating a culture or whether you are not thinking about creating a culture, you are creating a culture. Everything you're doing is creating a culture. And I would say one of the biggest myths that people have about culture is that we can wait until we have money to think about culture. Every decision you make, every person you hire, everything you do or don't do contributes to your culture. And the way that you make those decisions, the way you talk to each other, the way you don't talk to each other, whatever, that's all culture. I would say the biggest mistake that I see founder teams make all the time is hiring the wrong person. Whether that's an advisor, so not really a hire, or whether it's a team member or a co-founder, there are lots and lots of bad relationships. And a bad relationship ultimately is bad for the company. I would say that the sort of corollary to that is that founders often make the mistake of having lots of verbal agreements and never actually talking through what do we care about? What are we going to consider to be success? You know, what are the things that matter to each of us and to us collectively? You know, how are we going to make decisions? How are we going to resolve conflicts? Those kinds of conversations, unfortunately, often arise when you're already in the thick of a problem and you say, but wait a minute, I thought we, whatever, right? So I would say, from my point of view, just being unaware takes those different forms, but being unaware is the biggest mistake.
From a challenge standpoint, I mean, there are many. It's hard to know where to start. But I think, you know, what I see so often is company starts up, there's a really strong core team, there's a vision, everyone's committed. How do you keep it going? You know, how do you keep that pace, the commitment, and the focus going for you and your entire team? You know, at some point, it morphs from, you can't always be working at 110%, 120%. And, you know, then there's that challenge almost of transitioning and saying, okay, I can't continue to work 80, 90 hours a week. You know, we've got to bring this back a little bit. How do you do that? Keep moving ahead quickly and at the same time start to build the team. You're going to have to bring in other people. And, you know, keeping the culture at that point in time once you get beyond that core team in those early days.
And, you know, I see some similar things as well. I think one of the ways that one of the things great about startup culture, you know, sometimes is the collegiality and, you know, the way that those relationships started, you know, likely in school or a friend of a friend, so people feel really comfortable with one another. But to echo Julianne's point, you know, people are issuing stock via email and then, you know, scaling it back over the phone and, you know, things like that. And while everything's going well, you know, there's no problem. There's no problem until there's disagreement. And then, you know, what wins? The phone, the email, you know, so he should work with your Foley Hoag attorney. No, seriously, one of the biggest things I see is people say, okay, I get X percent of the company, you get Y percent of the company, and so on and so forth. And right away, talking in percents is not the way to think about it. Sure.
Is that appropriate?
Yeah. You know what? We can do questions throughout today. Yeah.
Cool. Do you think you want to do a dynamic equity split?
What do you mean by dynamic?
So it's supposed to fix where at the outset they say you get 50, I get 50, or 30, 30, 30. instead they say, like, let's create a rubric by which we'll earn equity in the company, and then, like, you know, every week we'll check in and say, like, how's it been, you know, this could address your issue of how do you keep fired up? Well, you know, every month, every week, every year, you're earning new equity you haven't decided at the beginning.
So there's always, typically there's a dynamic component of any equity grant in that there'll be some either reverse vesting or it'll be an option. So you don't outright get to own the stock typically as an employee or a founder, especially once the VCs come in. If you own too much, they're going to scale that back or extend your vesting to ensure that you're committed and you'll stay fired up. And I mean, in the way you described, I haven't typically seen that, but I've seen, you know, tie it to the chief scientist, some milestone, and then his or her equity will increase. You know, I've seen things like that. But we always advise startups to keep it simple, like the simpler, the better. And you know, and the reason to finish the point on why not to talk in percentages is because as new money comes in, everyone's going to get diluted. So if you used to have 50, but the VC now wants, you know, 50, well, the founders, that's going to have to push down what they previously held as a percentage. Mm-hmm. So if you talk in shares, it's easier to keep it straight, you know, what you actually have. But of course, there can always be some recalibration, you know, to continue to align incentives and to keep everybody motivated. But I'm not sure if I've seen exactly what you had in mind or, but, you know,
I think
there was something.
It's slicing the pie. I don't know if anyone's seen that in New York.
Anyway. It could be a good idea. You know, I just, as long as it's clear.
And in writing.
It sounds like a lot of millables for you either.
Yeah, either way, we love dynamic, you know. So.
we'll take another question.
So when it is in percentages, like, who does it usually go towards, like, when there is a problem, like, the person who's, like, the founder, or just, like...
Well, if it's percentages, everyone holding stock will own, and, you know, looking at the total pie, will own less of it once the new money comes in. I'm not sure if I'm articulating it the right way, but, you know, we call it crammed down. You don't get crammed down as the new money comes in. But you need the new money to grow. So the plan is that this new money will let you hire new people to expand, to continue to grow. So eventually, although you own less of a bigger pie, it's going to be worth more than when you held more of a less valuable pie.
So when it's like exchanging equity via email and stuff like that, who wins?
Oh, who wins that? Well,
the lawyer.
I mean, you know, so I'm not giving legal advice today. No, I'm really am just sharing my experiences and having a conversation. But I would have to know the facts and circumstances there, but I would say the initial correspondence is, there's a good argument that that should stand, but there's also valid arguments that the iterations down the road should stand, and that's why you don't want to get into that situation. So I really stop it there.
You can find Vaughn after the portion.
Happy to.
My next question is, are startups evaluating their liabilities and creating a strategy for including their own culture competence as a means for mitigating risk? Do you see this at all?
I might as well start with that one, being the insurance guy. Let's see, where does evaluating liability, you know, where are founders on that? It's way at the bottom of the pile. It's not something that most companies are looking at in the startup mode. It's about product development, it's about financing, and it's about recruiting people. That's where the focus is. We get that. So what we try to do is just help companies with some of the basics. You know, first of all, when it comes to liability and insurance, are you compliant? Are you do you have in place what you need to do to meet state and federal laws? Let's start with that. Check the box there. Then we try to look at contracts. From either contracts that you've signed, do you have the insurance in place that you said you did when you signed it? And you have, from an indemnification standpoint, do you have it backstopped? And then we also take a look, if you've got a board or investors, what did they want? What were they promised when they put money in? You know, so again, we try to keep it pretty simple because we know that liability is way at the bottom of the to-do list.
Yeah, basically I would say, you know, when we look at companies, we're often asking them to show us, for example, employment letters, and they may not even have that. and they may not even have any documentation of promises made about, you know, who is entitled to what or what kind of vesting schedule might apply. Again, we invest at seed stage, and so one of the things that we end up actually doing with companies we talk to is kind of holding their hands and getting them to actually take these steps. So, you know, I hate to throw water on the fire, but it's really not actually
It's not part of the equation.
It's not something founders are thinking
of. That's why
of.
I'm asking the question.
Definitely, and I think probably, you know, what I see is the most risky activity for that founders don't think about is just making sure the IP is assigned to the company, that, you know, the company actually owns its IP. And when you hire, you know, service providers, that they sign NDAs and your, you know, contract programmer assigns the IP back to the company. And that, you know, typically things coming out of universities, especially in the life sciences space, if you, you know, if you build it at MIT with their laboratory equipment, you don't own it, you know, so, unless you have an agreement with MIT. And people typically think, oh, no, I went home and thought about that, you know, but that's typically not going to work. And so just making sure the company owns what it thinks it does, you know, VCs, I believe, aren't going to invest in a company if they don't think you actually own what you're developing. And that's something that usually can get straightened out, but I see that come up frequently.
So for those of you in the audience, how many of you are at startups where you have a marketing strategy? Okay, and how many of you come from teams that have a culture strategy? A few of you. Okay. And has it helped your view of tracking, monitoring productivity, and also seeing the pain points of risk, maybe related to hiring or other big aspects of culture? Has it helped you plan for that accordingly? Has it helped you feel more prepared?
Well, for us, like, the marketing strategy is much more defined than the culture strategy, which feels kind of amorphous because it's sort of like...
developing.
Do we like these people? And we try really hard to get a really good fit, and you can see that that pays off, but it's hard to measure exactly. It's just like we know that we like working for each other and motivate each other, and that's in, it sort of spirals, and it like gets us up in the morning, and we love being there. And then by in reverse, when somebody's there that sort of like isn't a fit, like we've had to try to let them go quickly because you can see and feel more than see in terms of numbers or metrics that like things are awkward or like, things are kind of more difficult. But it's tough to put numbers on it. It's sort of more like a feeling.
Anyone else?
So we work all remotely. It's three of us. We only have base camp. And I find like working remotely is a good way to like keep the company culture. We're following like a lean method, you know, as I'm sure everyone is, so popular. But like lean, rework, these types of company philosophies we're trying to stick to. And remotely you test people by what they can produce. So there's no delegators, you know, no one whose job it is to manage other people's workflow. You judge them by what they can produce and you can see at the end of the day. Like I don't care, you know, if you're on Facebook the whole day, if you have good work at the end of it, it's fine.
Good input. Thanks. My next question is how to finding the right people and providing the right balance between benefits or perks that reflect the culture factor into your work? Does that come up as part of the discussion? And I know you work with benefits, so.
Yeah, I mean... for any company, I mean, the first thing they do when they engage us on the employee benefit side is benchmark. You know, tell us what everybody else is doing out there. And a lot of it is, some of it reflects culture. of the company, but I think more of it is taking a look at what do I need to do to recruit and retain people with a benefits and total rewards program, you know, versus necessarily aligning it with culture.
And you don't see the part about retaining and finding the right people, that's not part of culture?
Oh, I think that is definitely, you know, part of the culture, you know, mm-hmm. but in terms of the, you know, literally the, you know, the benefits that get, you know, put together,
the perks
again,
that,
is
yeah.
more external, you know, driven in terms of, hey, if we want to build a team here and keep the team that we have, you know, we've got to make sure that we're very competitive mm-hmm. with what we're providing our employees. And then there's already been some conversation around, you know, hiring and getting the right people in. I think the smaller you are, the easier that is. You know, if you're 10 or 12 people and, you know, someone comes in, chances are, if you're all working locally, you're all going to see and meet that person and you're going to know pretty quickly, do they fit or don't they fit? As you grow, and particularly if you're, you know, working remotely, it's tougher, you know, tougher to get a handle on, does this person fit or not? I mean, as you mentioned, maybe it's, you know, after a while you look at their output and you can make a decision, but how do you know going into it?
Julianne, how do you contend with teams that are struggling between the balance of finding the right people and offering the right... When I think of perks right now, especially coming out of Silicon Valley, it was insane a few years ago, and now it's even more out of control. I don't know how many of you have friends who are at startups in California, but the perks have reached a new height.
Yeah, we don't have that kind of dizzying silliness here.
No.
Not that, you know, dizzying silliness isn't fun, but we just don't have it. So I see that as much less of an issue. I see much more the challenge of, you know, choosing your colleagues, particularly when you're in a very small company, is it's a kind of high wire act, right? On the one hand, you want to choose people with whom you feel comfortable and productive. Very often, those are people who are a lot like you, right? Because the most natural thing is somebody who thinks like me, who has the same cultural references, who laughs at the same jokes, who might make the same jokes, right? That's kind of the first cut, and oftentimes that's actually not what's really in your interest. It is important to have an ease of relating with one another, but it's actually more important to have a mix of skills and a mix of perspectives and a mix of backgrounds, because launching a new company is a really high challenge task, right? And you're constantly going to have decisions to make which will be better made if you have a couple of different viewpoints to bring to bear. And so actually what I think is a really vital thing to look for is not necessarily do we all have kind of the same whatever presets, but how do we do at disagreeing? If we disagree well, we're going to work well, right? So if we can have a really good, like, I was trained as an engineer originally, right? You know, if you can have a really good whiteboard argument, and at the end of it, like, say, yes, you know, like, we've got through that, and not sort of carry away, you know, wounds and grudges and whatever, that's a really good thing, right? If you have emotional kind of disconnects, that's much harder, right? So there's this kind of balancing act between, you know, people with whom you feel immediately at ease and with whom you feel an immediate sense of kinship, like this is my tribe, right? And people who have enough of a different background, different training, different experiences, different sense of humor, different whatever, so that they're bringing different ideas to the table, and so collectively you can make sure to harvest the best ideas, not just the same ones. And that doesn't really have anything to do with perks. That's just all about choosing the people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think what I see sometimes end up influencing the development of a company, especially at the earliest of stages, is that, you know, the people, I mean, particularly your co-founders, but your first, second, third, fourth employees, you know, they need to be the type of people, not only talented, but that are willing to defer benefit, I think, sometimes. I'm not as familiar with Silicon Valley. It does sound fun. but, you know, if the person, you know, doesn't appreciate, well, you need to have an appetite for risk, and if they can't appreciate what can come down the road, well, then it's probably not a good fit at the earliest of stages. And where I see companies lose talent, like really good people, is because they can't pay a lot, you know, at the outset. You know, you have CEOs making $25,000 and things like that, you know, enough to live. So if Google comes by, or Big Pharma, or some, you know, a full ride to do your PhD, like, these are types of things I see take top talent from startups. And I can't blame the people that leave, you know. Everyone's in their own situation. So I think where I see the successful startups, the early group, I think they're able to wear more than one hat. You know, you got to just get it done. So if someone, and everything depends on the exact situation, but I think generally speaking, someone needs to be able to do more than maybe what they signed up for at an early stage startup to really make it successful. And so I think that's something you want to try to evaluate on the people you bring on board. You know, if someone only wants to work 9 to 5, I mean, unless they can get it done while on Facebook, like my friend said, they may not be a good fit, you know. So that's where I really see is lack of benefits maybe influencing the development. I think my colleague here might have had a question.
Yeah, well, just along those lines, I'm struggling right now with my ideal hire is a college grad right out of school, but I'm a college grad out of school, so, you know, are they going to respect me? Is it better going with someone a little bit older who's been around the block and knows, okay, this is a good thing? It's tough to figure out who's going to actually listen to you given my age and who won't, you know?
I mean, I sometimes advise, you know, people that run funds or high up in public companies, and I'm not necessarily their counterparts, but if what you're offering is legit, you know, it should speak for itself. You know, people take my advice when it makes sense, and, you know, and it's backed up by the law. So, I'm speaking for myself. For you, I mean, I know we've talked about what you feel, you know, feel it out. If you think the person can't handle it, you know, trust your gut. Maybe they can't, and you definitely don't want that, but I don't know. It's
tough.
Yeah, but there are so many people out there leading companies that are younger than you are.
Right.
That, you know, have people working with them of all different ages. I look at it, I wouldn't think it's the, you know, age is the issue. And again, I think you're going to know in that interaction you have right up front, hey, does this person understand the dynamic?
Right.
And am I going to be comfortable with it?
I think another thing to keep in mind is that the notion that there's any kind of control in a startup is, let's just say, misplaced. there's going to be almost everything beyond your control, and so really what you want to look for are people who will kind of help you focus on the things that you collectively need to focus on to make this company successful, whatever that means, right? And it will be important to figure out who has authority and who has responsibility over what, and to actually honor those agreements. But the really critical thing as you're thinking about who to bring on is really just to recognize that, you know, you're really going to be at sea for a while. And so, you know, who do you want to be at sea with? And choose those people. Does that help?
Yeah.
And you're not allowed to ask people how old they are anyway. So. Could be your best guess. Do you have any cautionary tales of founders weighing risks that you would like to share?
I love crash and burn stories because we don't tell them enough. And they're really important because we spend a lot of energy on these kind of, you know, glorified hagiographic things. You know, the visionary founder, the, you know, brilliant success, all nonsense. So, you know, it's never a good idea to tell somebody else's story. I can tell you a story from my own experience. One of the companies I was involved in myself, we, three founders together, we made the mistake of too early in the company's life bringing in somebody from a big company. And we naively made the same misjudgment that everybody else makes when they do that, which was, hey, you know, our customers are big companies, we're going to be partnering with big companies, we really need to have somebody in-house from a big company who speaks that language and blah, blah, blah. Wrong. It turns out that people from big companies, in many cases, never worked in startups, or in some cases did, but it was so long ago they've long since forgotten how to survive in that environment. And the internal tensions that causes actually ended up consuming a significant amount of our energies. So instead of all being focused on doing what we needed to do, we spent a lot of time trying to kind of resolve these internal disconnects about, like, well, why aren't we spending $250,000 on trade shows?
Because we don't have it.
And if we did, we'd spend it on other things. So, you know, the biggest mistake there was, again, really just not understanding what the company needed, right? And what we as founders really needed. And that misjudgment set us back something terrible. It was really costly.
I mean, I guess I'll go back to just IP and equity, you know, making sure that's formalized. And as a, it's not a horror story because it's still going on, so I don't know how it's going to end. But one of our clients was, you know, it was the case of the forgotten founder, you know, one of the three. He went off. He's like, oh, I don't want any parts of it. And, you know, they started raising money, and then all of a sudden he's like, oh, no, I own this amount, and I designed the IP, you know, right before they, you know, developed serious interest from some VCs, and they were trying to price them around. And so now this is a big disclosure that you have to make, you know, as a startup, and they took a hit. You know, they didn't get to, you know, get the valuation that they would have gotten because of this risk that was there. And the risk could have been mitigated simply by, you know, signing the right papers when the person left the company, having them, you know, just sign a release. You know, simple things that, you know, 3 years later, it really can affect the performance. And, you know, every dollar counts all the time, but especially exponentially at the early stages. So, you know, that's just, I guess, something I could keep coming back to as an attorney.
And I mean the risks are prolific, but one that we see all the time is growth via acquisition. You know, we have to grow. We want to grow fast, so let's go out and, you know, bring in another company that's hopefully complementary to us, and that's going to help us grow. It's going to look great to the investors. They're going to give us more money. Won't life be great? You know, in our experience, we just haven't seen that pan out all that often, where you take two companies, often at similar sizes and stages with distinct cultures, bring them together, and the sum becomes greater than the two parts. You know, usually it just, we don't see it ending all that well for either the acquired company or the, you know, the company that brought it in. But again, sometimes you've got a founder under pressure. You know, and it's just looking, how do I hit numbers? How do I get investors more interested? If I get bigger, will that do it? You're an investor.
I am. That's a great segue into my next question. It almost matches my scenario question exactly. A startup you advise is struggling with their team. They're rapidly growing and will most likely be acquired by an iconic tech giant soon. How do you help them prepare for these transitions that they're going through?
So first of all, call Vaughn and clean up everything.
No, I back up even more. Back up and call me.
There you go.
It'll save time, Vaughn.
I mean, I think it depends on what the leadership, what the founders are going to do. You know, if they're going to leave after being acquired, then, you know, that's one scenario. If they're going to stay, and if they're going to leave, then, I mean, the people that remain should expect to totally become a part of, the new company that's acquiring them. But perhaps, you know, if the leadership's staying on, which is typical, they could, you know, try to integrate cultures or try to maintain the culture of the target company. But getting ready to get acquired or for an IPO, yes, you have to cross all your T's, dot all your I's. You start bringing in some more expensive service providers like investment bankers. And, I mean, the culture might change because things will start to get formal. You know, if the way people spent money was more lax, that's going to tighten up. There may be more, I mean, because now the company is going to be getting audited and, you know, the casualness is going to start to go away. But I'm not the culture expert, you know, so not exactly sure.
But, you know, acquisitions are tough. I mean, and what you didn't describe is do the rank and file, does everybody know about the impending acquisition, or is it just, you know, the founders that know about it? Because I think from a founder standpoint, it's difficult. I mean, you've got a deal that you're working, it may not be all the way there yet. How open are you? I mean, how open can you be? And I'd leave that to Vaughn, but, you know, who can you tell? When can you tell them? What can you tell them? So you're kind of straddling the fence. You're looking at this, you know, great opportunity to exit and have a good payday. Perhaps the, you know, it brings your technology further along by merging into this company. But at the same point in time, you've got this, you know, dedicated team with you that's helped you build it. Mm-hmm. And how open can you be with them? How much can they make their own decision about what they want to do? How much, you know, is in it for them? Financially and otherwise, and how do you straddle that as a founder? I think that's difficult.
Yeah, so I'm glad you raised that point, because I think that's where it becomes important to do the rewind and to again have these very candid conversations really early on when there's not a deal on the table about what are we going to consider success, and if that happens, what might it look like, right? By the way, not every company needs to take investor capital, and not every company needs to find an exit. I mean, you know, there are lots of very profitable companies that never did either. So, you know, it's not a foregone conclusion that that's necessarily the end of the story for your company. It's also not a foregone conclusion that it's a particular kind of acquirer. So different kinds of acquirers mean very different things. And so, you know, even before you find yourself in the position of being in the negotiations phase, it's really important to make sure that everybody on the team understands what the goal is, what you're working towards together, and what that's likely to look like, so that what you don't have happen is a whole bunch of people sort of freaking out, you know, dogs and cats living together, end of the world, you know, whatever. So, the really surprising thing actually is when I meet with founder teams, I make a rule of asking them what does success look like. And it's actually quite rare that if there are two or more founders that they have the same answer. And so, you know, the... the thing I always tell them is, like, you know, go home, have a conversation, come back, tell me the answer. But, you know, like, don't make it up in front of me. This is an important conversation you guys need to be in agreement about. Because, you know, not only what happens if the deal goes through, but what happens if the deal doesn't go through? And, by the way, a deal is never done until it's done, and lots more of them fail than you hear about. So, you know, what happens if the deal doesn't go through? Then what? Then what are we, you know, working on? So, you know, it's terribly important before you find yourself in this position of having some amount of privileged or sensitive information that you may not be able to discuss with the team, to go into that situation with everybody on the same page.
That's a really good point, just being able to initiate that conversation and define what success looks like. Who here has had that conversation with their team members? Two of you.
Three.
I counted three. Three of you. Three of you. Okay. It's a start. Maybe there's some homework for you. So what are some of the biggest legal vulnerabilities that you see from the outside looking in? Bob, maybe you want to start. Do startups need to communicate these points more and make it part of their culture to discuss this more openly, or are these problems best swept under the rug, in your opinion?
I don't think anything's best swept under the rug. At least tell your attorney. Let he or she do the sweeping, you know. But I think that, you know, well, in terms of selling stock, it's surprising. Some people aren't aware that securities is a regulated industry. But it is. And so, you know, I've seen someone, you know, blow an exemption that we typically use to, you know, sell stock by talking about it on their Facebook. Like, oh, buy stock in my company. And then they just blew it because there's regulations on, like we said, who you can tell. So a lot of the exemptions on registering with the SEC come from not telling everybody. You know, it has to be private, not public. And so, you know, don't talk about your company on Facebook in terms of investing. Don't do that. Vulnerable on sometimes just offering people equity, you might, you know, get yourself into a little legal trouble. So it's just, it's a regulated industry, like driving, you need a license, or that's not an industry, but say alcohol, you need an alcohol license. You can't sell stock without a license or an exemption. And so call your attorney, or talk to your VC or your insurance, like, people know, you know, but sometimes founders don't, and it's surprising. It used to be surprising, not anymore. I don't take it for granted anymore. So that's one maybe on the equity side. And then in terms of being vulnerable, if you're moonlighting your startup and your day job is at Google, you know, you got to think about, are you going to own what you're working on? Because if it is going to compete with Google, likely not. But I know Google's actually really has a lot of policies that try to facilitate and promote people being able to do that, but, you know, the agreement's really long, it's really tedious, and, you know, you just have to, before you, you know, decide in your head you have a company, you really should just get some advice, and a lot of firms in the city, because of the startup culture and the activity, will talk to you about these big picture things, you know, for free, you know, so it's not always you have to sign up for this big bill to just get simple questions answered. So at least at my firm, so I'll say that.
There's even university resources in some of those as well, depending on where you go.
Mm-hmm.
Outside the offices, or technology transfers, what they do.
Exactly, yep.
And there are lots of folks who do free office hours at places like Venture Cafe and the like. So, you know, you really should be able to get at least basic questions answered.
And then to reiterate some of the things that Vaughn's gone over, I mean, I think from a liability situation that we just see too many companies leave open is the IP. And literally have, you know, heard founders say, don't worry, we'll hire the IP attorney later. And again, I know it's a challenge. I mean, you only have so much money. But I guess if I had to spend the money, and I hate to say this, I'd, you know, spend it on the attorney up front and lock that down. Because, you know, without that IP locked down, what's the value of the company?
Yeah, and then you may be surprised the answer you get from your IP attorney, because I've heard some IP attorneys, which is not explicitly my field, separate specialized attorney, but they'll advise people to not file patents because that's a public document, you know, so it's just, well, just finish it up first, you know. So they may surprise you, and you might not need a patent from day one. And a lot of things like mobile apps, people aren't filing really patents for those as frequently as you might think. And so, you know, just reiterating the group in a way is you seek out the advice early to avoid potential problems.
That's often the advice that people give when it comes to their startup culture. When I interview founders, the number one piece of advice is, well, I wish that I paid attention to my culture sooner. And really, you need to be on top of everything sooner. which risks do you see startups willing to take on a regular basis? Is there anything that comes to mind where they say, your advice? No, I'm going to just do my own thing over here.
So I would say that there are considered risks and there are unconsidered risks. I think that the considered risks are pretty typical, that people are aware that they're deciding, for example, to forego income, and they're deciding, you know,
to hire someone.
Right. I think the unconsidered risks are much bigger, and they're ubiquitous, right? So, you know, I'm just going to do this in my spare time and, you know, see what happens. That's a really big risk. Or I'm just going to do a crowdfunding campaign and see what happens. That has blown up companies. Or I'm just going to work with some friends for a little while, and, you know, then we'll figure it out, right? No. That's where you end up with these, like, you know, lost founder stories. So I would say that the considered risks are, you know, pretty much exactly what you would imagine they are. You know, what are we really undertaking together? What are we willing to go through? You know, whatever. The challenge really is to surface as many of your assumptions and preconceptions as you possibly can. Because the reason they're unconsidered is that you haven't looked at them, right? They're kind of back here, outside your peripheral vision. So, you know, what I advise people to do is talk to other folks who are founders, you know, peers. Go to, you know, whatever free office hours you can sign up for, whether it's through your university or through other settings. You know, socialize your assumptions with other people. And very often, especially if they're like two steps ahead of you or more, and it really only needs to be like two, then, you know, they'll be able to tell you, oh, well, you know, you should be thinking about this, or, you know, like you really ought to make sure that you pay attention to this other thing, whatever, right? And so kind of getting all the stuff that's back here out of your field of view into your field of view so that they can be considered is just really the enormous risk reduction in my mind, right? Because the unconsidered risk is always the thing that's just going to bite you in the ass.
And on the considered risk front, I mean, the two stop signs or yellow lights, I guess, would be better that we see people go through all the time are, I don't care what the contract says, you know, we need this customer. You know, just, you know, I heard your advice, thank you, but we're signing it anyways. And again, it's always, you know, up to you as founders as to how you're going to run your business. But, I mean, again, and this is just seeing it not even necessarily from the legal side, but just from some of the ramifications that come up from an insurance standpoint, when you just, you know, agreed to indemnify Google, good luck with that one. And, you know, they'll hold you to it to a great degree. So there's that part of it because, again, there's that pressure to get the deal done, you know, get the customers in the door. But what happens a year or two down the road if it doesn't all go well? Then that contract that you signed comes back to bite you. The second thing is international expansion. Some companies just, you know, geez, we need to be in France, just to pick on France. And I just think a lot of companies rush into international expansion without understanding how different it is operating in many countries overseas than it is in the U.S., that you can't just shut down an office or an operation on your whim, that there's a lot of longer-term liability and expense associated with that. And again, I know that, you know, lawyers and others advise people on that, yet we continue to see companies just march across and open up offices internationally.
I think a considered risk that I see frequently, but it's one that been successful in convincing clients to forego, is we don't need to issue ourselves stock right now. Like, we're okay. We're all working on this. We don't need to actually have the stock because they don't want to get formal. They don't want paperwork. Apparently, signing things is really difficult for really smart people. They just signing wrong in the header. I'm like, yes, I don't mind. But I've seen a lot of different things. But the problem you can run into is if you don't issue your stock early to yourself, then when the investors come, you're going to have a problem saying, okay, we issued ourselves stock at...